Survivor Specialist John and McKenna are back, and we are so excited to talk this episode of 47, but in the past.
Yeah, I'm really excited. This was another good episode. Like, I know I was a little tentative after the premiere. After some time, like, I sat with it. It felt really good. I quite enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed the different dynamics we're seeing from these tribes. McKenna, how did you feel about episode 2?
I felt a lot better than episode 1, that's for sure. I am enjoying this season and so excited to, like, dive into this.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, especially when we look at this episode and just seeing the way that the edits from the premiere kind of concealed a lot about these players. And we get to go on this learning journey with these players as we go this season, because in that first episode, I think there were a lot of people who felt a lot of different people who seemed very secure spots in the premiere feel quite differently after watching this episode. I think there were just these moments where someone like TK, who seems like this big power player on his tribe, obviously goes alpha bro and says bro probably more than anyone else, like, cumulatively has said the word in all of Survivor. But it was just interesting seeing that dynamic switch, even like seeing Teeny, who seemed almost infallible in that premiere, goes and like does this whole thing with showing Keyshawn the idol that Rome showed her and everything. And Andy, who seemed like he was completely on the outs, having Sam literally asking the question, like, should I play my idol on Andy? I think episode 2 really changed the dynamics for this entire season, and I'm really excited to watch it moving forward.
Yeah. And there were some people that are still invisible that, like, give me a little bit more suspicion on how they do. Like, Genevieve, we haven't heard from a lot. Caroline, even though she went to tribal council, we haven't really heard from a lot. Like, we're still missing some characters.
Absolutely. And like Phil mentioned this on Wednesday's recap, it's just this idea that, like, yeah, okay, like, Phil has this big theory about, like, and like it's substantiated by looking at the last several seasons, like since Erica's win, the people who make it far in the game get confessionals every episode. So Genevieve, like, missing a confessional this episode doesn't bode well for her longevity in the game. However, it's very possible the Red Tribe just never goes to Tribal Council. So
we'll see.
It's interesting. I enjoy where the season's going. I think we have some very interesting things that kind of developed in this episode that we get to talk about with these, like, moments from the past this week. And it's just so nice seeing a second tribe going to Tribal Council in the second episode of a season of Survivor.
Everyone was like, whoa, is Gata gonna be, you know, the disaster tribe this season? Because pretty much we've had a lot of disaster tribes these last few new era seasons, so it's refreshing to not see that. But without further ado, John, you ready to dive into our outwit, outplay, and outlast moments?
I sure am, McKenna.
All right. But before we do, please like the video, subscribe to the channel, and subscribe to Patreon. Become a patron. We love you over there, because you'll get another episode of Survivor Rewind over there. All right. So let's dive into our outwit moment. Babysitting. We have Sam babysitting Andy so he doesn't do anything squirrely. And we thought this was beautiful because we've seen this in Survivor before, and we really wanted to touch upon it.
Yeah, so obviously in this episode of 47, the whole idea is, okay, Andy's on the outs, he's the very clearly obvious target, so we have to make sure he doesn't have an idol. And the way we do that is we take turns, we rotate, we watch him. But Sam decides to go to the washroom, and all of a sudden, Andy's like, yeah, I'm out.
Can you time really to go call look. It a washroom?
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. In Canada, we call them washrooms.
Bathroom. I know, but take a leak in the woods.
Sure. Takes a leak. He goes, takes a leak. And And because of that, like, Andy's off running around, finds the beware advantage. I mean, baffling decision not to take the beware advantage there, but, you know, I kind of respect it.
Mm-hmm.
However, completely blows up in his face immediately when, you know, someone else takes it. But this type of babysitting, like, we've seen it so many times since the evolution of the idol, because that's the only time that babysitting's been needed. You don't need to babysit when there's no chance of someone going off into the woods and finding an idol, because you can just shut down conversation with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I feel like your example is one of the more perfect, beautiful moments of babysitting.
Yeah, I agree. And this is one of those ones that, like, isn't a babysitting because of the idol. It's just a babysitting because you don't know what this player is going to do. And of course, I mean, we'd be pretty remiss not to mention the best example of babysitting a tribe member and then leaving them be and disaster strikes. And that is in the premiere of Kageyan, when everyone is supposed to be watching Jatia and it doesn't happen. And Jatia decides, you know what? You left the mental patient alone. Like, what are you doing? And dumps out all the rice.
Yeah, this is unprecedented, really, because no one thinks that she's just going to dump the rice in the fire, because this is her food too. Like, why would you dump the rice if you're eating from that as well? Like, that's just case in point, you're going home.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there are a lot of things that, like, lead up to this moment in this episode. Mm-hmm. Because you have to think, we need this, like, perfect storm of events to occur, right? Obviously, Luzon loses again. And then Garrett decides, hey, let's just chill in the shelter and, like, not go off and talk to each other. Which irritates Tasha to the point where she's like, no, Cass, let's go talk. Which then makes it so that Garrett and Spencer, like, oh, shit, like, we need to go talk to them because, like, this is bad, which then just leaves Jatia alone in camp, clear, like, as the clear target for this vote. So she just decides, F it, I'm going to dump the rice. Let's put it all in the fire. And there's that moment of realization on the beach, like, oh, you guys left Jatia alone?
Mm-hmm.
And then it cuts to them returning to camp, and Gaz is like, where did all this rice come from? It's in the fire. She's like, oh, I don't know. It's just so funny. It goes to prove that, like, there are moments in Survivor where you don't need to, where you're babysitting not because of an advantage that could be found, and instead you are just watching someone to ensure they don't do the exact
whatever that was thing.
Yeah, I don't even know how to explain it, right? Like, it is such an absurd moment in Survivor history, and it's part of the reason why this Kageyan premiere is considered one of the best episodes of Survivor. How were you ever supposed to expect this? And what lesson do you learn from it? Hey, if someone's an obvious boot, make sure they're, like, being watched at all times. You can't do that. Like, realistically, you can't do that in Survivor. So what are you supposed to take from this moment?
Listen, I don't know.
Just the entertainment value of it?
You're supposed to take from it, just decide on someone to vote out in a shelter and not go strategize because it's raining.
Honestly, I truly wonder if they just did their, like, normal scramble stuff and Jatia had the moment to, like,
Jatia's fine.
Talk to Tasha, talk to Cass. Like, this probably never happens. So really, this all goes back to Garrett.
What a beautiful disaster.
Yes. I mean, one of my favorite Survivor players, just for how much of a disaster he truly is.
My moment is going to be with Tina in Blood versus Water. The loved ones' alliance is kind of being whittled down here, and she is one of the last remaining pairs, and she is trying to find the idol, but we as the audience know Tyson, that sneaky, sneaky man, has the idol already in his pocket. And he hasn't told anybody that he has the idol. So he has to fake, you know, everyone has to keep an eye on Tina. Everyone has to watch Tina And then Tina just like nonchalantly is like going and looking in the woods and like, you know, it I think it's just such a funny scene where like people walk up on Tina and she's like, not doing anything.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because this is coming off of the Vetus boot. So this is a tribal council where Vetus and Katie are getting all of the votes. So mm-hmm. Tina, like, realizes how bad of a position she's in. And she's like, I have to go get this idol. All I know about it is this one clue that Katie told me that is between salt water and fresh water. Could be literally yeah. anywhere. And goes off looking for it. But the interesting thing about this moment is Tyson already has the idol.
Mm-hmm.
Tyson knows that Tina can't find the idol. But Tyson has to play along with this idea of we have to follow Tina so she doesn't find the idol to throw off any scent that he has the idol. And these are some of those underrated moments, I think, in Tyson's winning game in Blood versus Water. And it's just, it's so fascinating watching him because he is the person who suggests, you know what, we should probably keep an eye on her so she doesn't find the idol. And then on the opposite side of that, Tina can't look for the idol because if she looks for the idol, then everyone knows she doesn't have the idol.
Right. She has to play it at some point being like, oh yes, I totally have the idol, everyone. And Tyson's just like, sure, Tina.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a this fascinating, like, duplicitous game that these two all-stars of the game, like two of arguably, like, I mean, two winners of Survivor have to play against each other. Yes, I know Tyson hasn't won at this point yet. but have to play with each other, and they kind of have to just play this, like, game of chicken with each other in order to, and it's not to deceive each other, it's to deceive everyone else around them. It's fascinating
yeah.
how this evolution of the game worked in this exact instance, and how both Tyson and Tina have to weaponize it to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting. The three element, like the three examples of babysitting are so different from each other, but still like have the same core strategy of like, don't you have to babysit people so they don't do something you don't want them to do.
Yeah, and it's been a core like credence of Survivor for a while, obviously. Like some of the more egregious examples of it like involve Boston Rob and the buddy strategy and things mm-hmm. like that, where that's a different style of babysitting, where the babysitting is, hey, if everyone's in pairs, no one can sneak off and do the sneaky thing.
Right.
Doesn't yeah. really help if like a pair decides to do that, like we see in Winners at War when Sarah and Sophie just decide, yeah, no, we're not doing this. But it leads to this interesting like layers of the strategy and social parts of the game coming together in order to prevent people from getting any foothold in the game.
Exactly. We ready to move on to our outplay moment?
Sure.
All right. So we all know my favorite part of the game is the challenges. So we are actually talking an element of the challenge this time, and we are talking group mazes, because I find it always really interesting early on in the game. Granted, they are like living with each other and there's only six of them, like 24/7, so you get a kind of handle on people's names and like how to work with them a little bit better. But like when it's early on in the game, it's so interesting to me when we find, you know, group things where there's a caller or where there's like you have to work together to do something. So this table maze of sorts is like really fun in an early episode, because you see people like flame out, like TK, where he's so frustrated, but then you have Gata just slow and methodically working through this because they were put to the test already. They were, you know, in the sand before. They know how what it feels like losing, and they're just slow and steady. We've got this.
It's really interesting because I think this is, I mean, this is a new type of table maze that we haven't really, I mean, table mazes, for a lack of a better word, that we haven't seen in Survivor before. And what's so interesting, again, I agree, these mazes are so fascinating when they're done at a team perspective, because it makes it so that there's no hiding, right? Like, yes, you can mess up this thing, but especially with this version where it's dealing with slack on rope and like navigating this maze with these three from 3 points, which are really hard to control. Like 3 points is hard to control with. And when you're doing that, it's all about communication. And that's what we see the difference being between Gata and Tuku here, is, and even like Lavo to some extent, right? Like,
yeah, Lavo drops a few times, but then eventually is just like, ah, we've got it now.
Yeah, and you can see that in them as they're progressing through the challenge, right? Like, they know what they're doing, they understand the communications, and they develop their communication skills throughout. Whereas Tuku, it seems, is kind of struggling with that communication, that basic element, because they have such a large personality in someone like TK, who, like, takes that leadership, not even really a leadership role here, but like kind of like that.
He amplifies the frantic energy because they are a little bit behind. So he doesn't calm the group. He just kind of escalates the urgency, and that's not what you want in something like this. So like, I'm going to go to my example here, and we're going heroes versus villains. And that's where Rob is the caller for this table maze. And I think Rob is a really good person to put in this role here, because he is a calming factor and is level-headed and can easily guide his people to do what they need to do to secure the win on this maze. This is the one that Russell Swan collapsed on. So it's the giant traditional type of maze, but it's on like a pivot in the center, and then four people on the four corners, and you have to navigate a ball from one corner to the other corner. So I'm a big fan of seeing this specific maze in the challenge, because we have the blindfolded element, we have the caller, we have just communication within the tribe of like, all right, when we say up, do we mean like push a corner up? Do you mean bring it over? Like, just how to navigate how the puzzle works too is really fun.
Yeah. And again, I think the big thing with this one is it is, because there's a caller element to it, obviously it really emphasizes the communication needed in this challenge. Mm-hmm. And while it was like, obviously like shocking not seeing this challenge in effect in Samoa, because like Russell Swan collapses and everything, when we do finally see it in Heroes vs. Villains, we really get an idea of exactly how this challenge was supposed to work. And we see, like you said, with Rob calling it, we see the what it takes in order to truly communicate through this challenge. It's just one of those things where, because we don't have any blindfolded challenges anymore, we don't really get to talk about how important a caller is. Mm-hmm. And whereas you also have to think of how important the listeners are.
Yeah.
Like those who are being directed need to be able to take directions. If we are looking at this through like a 47 lens, and we have the Tuku tribe, I imagine you probably have TK as caller, because he would want that type of role. Mm-hmm. But is he the best person to be calling, or is he going to irritate people? And will people be able to listen to him? Or do you have someone like Kyle, who everyone seems to get along with, calling, and then you probably still have TK wanting to be one of the people there, so he might not react well if things are going well and frustrated and can't do anything about it. So these type of mazes are so important. And the interesting thing about the Heroes vs. Villains maze is everyone's just in charge of a corner. Mm-hmm. Right, when you think about these type of like labyrinth that you solve, like the marble labyrinth that you solve, right, where you're navigating it with like the two pistons or the two dials, you're doing that from the sides, not from the corners. When all you have to control is a corner, it's so hard to figure out exactly how high and how low you have to do it, because you have to do it in conjunction with the rest of your teammates in order to move the ball in a specific direction.
Something different, though, about, you know, this one from Heroes versus Villains, they have done this specific table maze before, and Rob specifically did it in Marquesas. Like, they did this challenge in Marquesas. So, like, though these people are not returnees, like, this example, Rob probably had a good idea going in because it was in his season prior, so he utilized that to his advantage moving forward. And, like, since the table maze specific portion of it didn't really get played in Samoa, Russell Hance has no contribution to, you know, kind of the inner workings of how the puzzle can go down. Because, like, Heroes versus Villains was all about, you've done this challenge or an element of this challenge before, you take over. So Rob here is the perfect caller, not only because he is that calming presence, but has elements of, I've done this before.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where experience reigns, and, like, table mazes are tricky. Like, table mazes are always trickier than they seem. And, like, I think that was one of the big things in 47 is, yes, in concept, this isn't terribly difficult until you have to, like, navigate these holes that are randomly on this stake that you are trying to get this ball through.
Also, it's probably not as complicated when $1 million is not on the line.
That is also a good point. But, I mean, speaking of overcomplicating things, my example for this outplay and group mazes in general comes in the Heroes, Healers, Hustlers premiere, where in the immunity challenge, the tribes, they're doing, like, an obstacle course thing. And eventually, like, as they get through the obstacle course, they have an option between three different table mazes. And this is kind of, like, when we think of, like, paired people doing table mazes, this is the table maze we think that they're doing. It's a long table maze where they control the ball and they're trying to guide it down to the end of the maze and get it in the hole. And there are three different variants in this challenge. There is one that is a more complicated maze, but it has, like, solid walls for almost the entire way. There's, like, one or two sections where you have to navigate, like, around a wall where there's no edge and the ball can fall out.
Yeah.
There's the more typical one that we usually see that has, like, the diamond in the middle and, like, a couple of humps you have to go over.
It's like that, like that. Uneven surface kind of one.
And then it's the straight shot one that's, like, straight down all the way. It has very short walls on either side alternating. So they're never, it's never like you have two walls at the same time. It's just like, here's one wall on the right, here's one wall on the left, and gets down to the end. The heroes are the first tribe to get to the maze. So they get to select what maze they're doing. They choose the one with the walls that's easy to guide the ball down, and you don't have as much risk of falling. Keeping in mind that this is the more complicated maze. There's a lot more turning and stuff you have to do on this maze. The hustlers get their second. They choose that, like, more traditional one with the humps and the diamonds and everything like that, which leaves the healers with the straight shot. And it's really interesting watching this because this iteration of these table mazes that are being done by multiple people, there are people, like, the people not actually lifting the table and everything are being very vocal about the strategies to approach these things. Predominantly, you see it with the healers, where Rourke is telling them, yeah, okay, as soon as you get to the one where there's a right wall, just slant tightly a little to the right, and then reverse it when you get to the next one. And, like, that's how you do it. And you see that the healers are able to finish this almost instantly.
Yeah, I like these table mazes because we see them a lot as single player, but it adds such a different element when you add one more person and you're only on one side, and it's like it's half of the puzzle is out of your control. As a more current example, like, I just love the Titanic of Jesse and Noelle trying to, like, maneuver it together as one person, and then they were like, all right, no, like, please stop that. But it's so great having this table maze with two people, because you have to try and like communicate that, like try and like get that specific communication rather than like Rob being like, Parvati up, you know. It's a little more, it's a little harder in my opinion to communicate that movement of the two people rather than, you know, a bigger maze like the other table maze.
I think this maze might actually still be hard. Like, even in all of these iterations, this type of, like, with two people moving up and down, I think is harder than what we saw in 47. 47 is difficult for many different reasons. But the thing with 47 is you don't have to worry about, like, tensing up when it seems like the ball is about to fall off as much as you do when you're actually holding the table that the ball is balancing on. I think that's what makes this
less overcorrecting. It's just, oh shoot, we dropped the ball in the hole. Where like with these table mazes, if someone overcorrects too much, there it is, and you're lost.
Yeah, there's just so much need for, like, you have to be completely in sync with the person that you are doing this with. Otherwise, you're just going to put your tribe so far behind in this challenge. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Alrighty, we ready to go to our outlast?
Sure are.
This is my favorite category we have today, because it was just such a fun moment, and it really brought me back to old school Survivor with Rachel putting all the rice in her pocket. Genius idea. I'm surprised that we haven't had someone try this before in any of the seasons, because I feel like there's been other, you know, bags of rice situations. So she shoves her pockets absolutely full of rice. And then Jeff is just like, you want to empty those pockets? And she's like, what pockets? And then all of the rice comes pouring out, and then she goes back to camp. But it was just like such a nostalgic feeling of like, she almost got away with it. How did these people going on rewards in old school Survivor get away with things like that?
Well, I think it comes down to something very simple. Production let them.
I know.
But, and that is the big difference. It's actually very interesting, because in doing research for this, I came across a Reddit thread that was like, hey, why don't people like smuggle rewards back and stuff? And Eric Reichenbach actually responded to it saying, yeah, production doesn't let you. Like, the rules are you have to eat your reward where the reward is served. Mm-hmm. And like, you can't do anything else with it, because that's silly and that's how rewards work. And
yeah, I read the one article with Lauren. They poured a whole bunch of alcohol in all of their containers, and then all of a sudden doing like confessionals and stuff like that, they were all sloshed and they had to empty their water bottles because they were all full of alcohol.
Yeah, so it's just really interesting, because I think the mentality towards this has changed. And obviously in the new era, we are dealing with this idea of more scarcity in the resources that the tribes are given. So, like, good on Rachel for seeing an opportunity and trying to, like, capitalize on it. Is it great when Jeff calls you out at the challenge and tells you to empty your pockets? Probably not from an optics perspective.
Not bad. Like, for me, if I was on the other tribe, I would have been like, that's genius and hilarious. Not like, I mean, for me, in my brain, I wouldn't have been like, oh, noted.
Really? Because, like, I feel like that would be one of those things where it's like, I would have never thought of that, which means she's thinking on a completely different level than me, which makes it really hard for me to be able to, like,
for me, I'd be like, I want to be that girl's friend. That's like, fair. That's smart. I want that.
Fair. Although also, like, that has to be the grodiest rice in the world.
I mean, Ghost Island's rice passed through Jacob Derwin's sock. So, like,
that is correct. I mean,
there are pocket rice than sock rice.
I'm not talking about the fact that it's a pocket. I'm talking about the fact that this rice is probably super old and was just dragged through the ocean.
It's already pre-salted.
Okay. That's fine. But like you said, this does really harken back to old school Survivor. And we'd be pretty remiss not to mention a moment where people went on reward and came back and brought food. So, I mean, let's take you back to Vanuatu here, McKenna. Let's just go back.
And my really dog hairy hat.
Oh, yeah, it's very dockery. But yeah, let's take you back to Vanuatu, because there's that moment where it's the coconut chop challenge. So there's, what, final nine, I think? Sounds about right. There are three guys left, so that means nine, right? Yes. Final nine. And it's the coconut chop challenge. All the guys get out first. It comes down to Leanne and Twilight, I want to say. And Leanne ends up winning, decides to take Julie, and they're going on a helicopter ride to a volcano to eat some chicken wings. And, you know, we see them bowing down in these chicken wings, but where the real excitement of this comes from, and what makes this instance a little more exciting than some of the other instances, like, obviously, if we go back in the early seasons of Survivor, we see people coming back from rewards, smuggling food for the tribal lot. You have Thailand, where Clay and Brian fill their canteens with soup and beer and bring that back for everyone. But what's so interesting about this Vanuatu moment is Leanne, Julie ties a bag of wings around her leg, gives two wings to each of the women, and then they, like, surprise the men that, oh, hey, look, we brought chicken bones back that you guys can eat the remnants of the meat off of.
And we can make soup with them after or something like that.
And the men are stoked, and the women are all like, we all have to pretend that this is awesome, but we just had actual chicken wings.
Yeah, and they're just getting they're also getting the bones, because everyone has to pretend that they didn't just eat chicken wings either.
Yeah, it's one of those fascinating things where, again, it's the gaming, and, like, that episode is the one, I'm pretty sure that episode is called, like, Gender Wars something something, like, it's getting bigger or deeper or something like that. It really just kind of emphasizes this idea of, like, the split between the men and the women in Vanuatu and what was happening there. It's fascinating because it's this weaponization of knowledge, it's this weaponization of reward that in earlier Survivor, this type of schemey way of approaching bringing a food reward back would be really maligned. But by the time we get to Vanuatu, it's like, no, this is sick. Yes,
this is hilarious. Yeah. I love this moment in Vanuatu. It is like pure gold that, you know, the women get this nice protein boost and the men just get these like remnants of the protein boost. It's just like chef's kiss. But for my moment, we went a little bit different, since this was food at the challenge that she was trying to bring home. There was only one thing you could go with, and that is the grossest challenge to ever exist on Survivor, and that's South Pacific, when they are eating all or biting all of that meat off of that roast and weighing it and spitting it and everything that you could imagine on it. And then Upolu wins, and as a reward, Jeff's like, you know what, I'll give you that meat. And then Coach is like, yeah, spit and all. And then I think Michaela was like, oh, we gotta wash off all that spit. And it's just so gross, so disgusting, but they took food from the challenge that wasn't part of the reward. Like, I feel like he just threw that extra. I'm not sure if that was meant to happen, but it felt very just extra.
It feels the way that Jeff presents it, and of course we're watching an edit of the show, but it feels like Jeff is just like, yeah, you know what, it'll be hilarious if they take all this spit-soaked meat back with them. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, granted, like, the reward for that challenge is bread, spices,
yeah,
some veggies. Clearly, I think the meat is supposed to be part of it. But the fact that Jeff doesn't mention the meat until the end is so funny. And it's, if you haven't watched this challenge on South Pacific in a while, let me remind you, it is the grossest thing we have ever
seen. But also, because this is the episode that we're watching over on the Patreon. So it's Taste the Victory. Even grosser name when you know what the challenge is. It's South Pacific episode 5. So become a patron and watch that with us over there. Continue, John.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about this challenge, and I think there's a reason why we've never seen it before, probably because of Cochran mentioning the fact that like everyone probably has oral herpes afterwards. And the idea of, oh, wait, we didn't think about communicable diseases. We should probably think about that next time we make a challenge like this. It's sloppy. It's disgusting. For some reason, these pigs have barbecue sauce all over them just for like the visual of how gross this is.
Also because they're cut, because it's cut up and like has those nice little squares, it's like slicing everybody's gums and lips and everybody's cut up. Jeff asks, shocked that so many people were had like injuries from the challenge at Tribal Council. And I'm like, Jeff, what do you expect? They're gnawing into this giant hunk of meat that has like a crust and a skin over it. Of course, they're gonna like get, I don't know, cut up. And then, so say one of the cuts is really bad and now they're bleeding into this meat. Like, this challenge clearly was just not thought out.
No, and then they, you know, feed them. And
but they interesting... have done it before. And I want to say like way back. Like it was like Australia or something like that.
It was something similar. It wasn't to this extent though, I felt.
No, like this one was like on crack.
Yeah. But... And the thing with this, I mean, if you've never had like the crackling of a pig, which is like that outer skin on a roasted pig, it's tough. It's very hard. So it makes sense as to why their mouths are all bleeding and why they're getting cut up. Ozzy says he like dislocated his jaw. Don chips a tooth. This is a brutal challenge, and it's kind of got this joyous moment of what? Upolo goes back with like 22 pounds and 14 ounces of meat. That's a good chunk of meat. That's a very good chunk of meat
for seven of them at that point, I think.
But they also have to wash 22 pounds and 14
ounces. And that'll get all the barbecue sauce off.
I know. It's okay. They have seasoning. They have, actually, I'm pretty sure, if I recall correctly, in the scene where it shows them eating it, they have more barbecue sauce. So I think there was barbecue sauce included in the reward.
Well, Brandon had his like what Cajun seasoning to it too, so he was like, yeah. But we will talk more of that later. So it's just a different version of like taking food from a reward, but a lot grosser and a lot weirder. And we just wanted to make you guys suffer a little bit with us.
I wonder, if Jeff didn't say, hey, you guys can take this meat, if somebody would have asked if they could have taken it.
Yeah.
I think they would, right?
I feel like the only other time we really see this is like Panama, where they're chopping up that fish and they can either take the extra beans or the extra rice. Right. And then they get the fish, you know, but then it's raining. They can't cook the fish, the whole sushi.
Yeah. And I mean, like we've seen different challenges where they like get rewards through the challenge, like the Fruit Ninja challenge in Hidoli, right? So it's very interesting that like there are elements of these other things in here. It's just Survivor decided in South Pacific, we're going to do the grossest thing possible. And the fact that the
cameras in the baskets, watching them like spit on top.
But like the fact that we have a moment in Survivor 47 that can harken back to this, thankfully not as gross, it's just Rachel stuffing her pockets. But that being said, like this is a very like visceral memory of Survivor, and we get to harken back to it because season 47 is so far delivering.
Yeah, it's delivering, and the episodes we've decided to watch, Redemption Island and South Pacific.
Well, I didn't say we were delivering, but
it's crazy. But I'm so excited to keep talking Survivor 47 and see what episode 3 has in store for us next week. John, wrap up what else we got going on this week.
Well, we have so much going on. If you haven't already, make sure you check out the recap that Phil and Blake did. That's why there's no digging deeper this week, because Blake joined Phil on the recap, so you got all their joint ideas together there on Wednesday night. McKenna and Blake just talked about the double eviction in Big Brother, so check that out. They'll also be back on Monday to discuss whatever happens in the fallout of it. Might be exciting, might not be that exciting.
No.
And then on Sunday, Phil will be joined by Carl Boudreaux from David vs. Goliath at 11 a.m. Eastern to do the power rankings. We're always excited when Carl comes back. He hasn't been back for a little while. So that is definitely one you're going to want to tune in for. Then over on the Patreon, we have Every Season's Matter happening. Palau still in full force on that. Saturday, you will hear McKenna and I talk about South Pacific, Episode 5. Tuesday, this past Tuesday, Phil and I just talked about Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Great Island movie. Fantastic suggestion by Phil. This coming week, we're going to be sneak previewing one of the movies from our top 10 underrated horror movies, which we're going to talk about on the 6th or the 7th of October. But next week, you get Lake Mungo. Trust me, underrated horror movie. You haven't seen it. Definitely go check that out. And Phil's still trucking along, talking Australian Survivor. I think part 4 comes out tomorrow. There's just so much content there. If you want Survivor, if you want reality TV, like, the Patreon's the place to be. But other than that, we will see you next week.
Goodbye, everyone.